Tax and the Senate Finance Committee with the opportunity to listen to Dr. Stinson and the commissioners. At the outset, though, Senator Scoy and I wanted to just make a couple of introductory remarks. Senator Scoy?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to the Tax Committee. Here's the first meeting of 2013. Hopefully going to be a good year. We've got a lot of work to do. We know that there's a lot of discussion across the state and in the area about tax reform and where we're going to go with that. So we're certainly looking forward to that. Being that this is the first Tax Committee meeting of the year and we're not scheduled to have another one for a little while, I wanted to introduce my staff. So if you have questions concerning committee schedules or other things, and I also was going to introduce the nonpartisan staff if you need information with regard to tax-related issues. My committee administrator is Cap O'Rourke. Cap's behind me. Committee LA, Donovan Hurd. Nonpartisan counsel, Nora Pollock. Nora here somewhere. Shelby McQuaid, fiscal analyst for the Tax Committee. Jack Paulson, fiscal analyst, does a lot of the property tax runs. Chris Voller is our page. So those are the members. I hope they're all raising their hands if they're in the room. But anyway, we will be meeting the division more during the early part of the session here. Senator Rest is delayed this morning, so she's not here. So she'll introduce her staff and talk about that when she has her first committee meeting. But Tax Committee members, welcome this morning.
And on behalf of the Finance Committee, a couple things. We are going to have another very quick committee meeting right after this upstairs in our regular room of 123, simply for the confirmation of Commissioner Showalter. So I'd ask members to go up to 123 as quickly as possible. It should not be a long meeting, assuming people are not angry about the appointment, the reappointment of Commissioner Showalter. Would like to just briefly introduce the full committee staff. Serving as the committee administrator this year is Nicole Kaplan, who I think is seated behind somewhere. Joshua Nye is new to the Senate, working as the legislative assistant. Eric Nauman has been promoted. All of you know Eric, who's worked for decades as the K-12 fiscal analyst, has now succeeded Mr. Gustafson as the chief fiscal analyst of the Senate, and Tom Bodern will continue to serve as counsel to the Senate Finance Committee. This morning, we've got the chance, as we often do, and for those of you who are new to either tax or finance, I'll suggest, I don't know if a real treat would be quite the phrase, but the opportunity to listen not only to Commissioners Showalter and Franz, but Dr. Stinson, the state's chief economist. And one of the things that I've been able to do as finance chairman is spend quite a bit of time listening and learning from Dr. Stinson. One of the most valuable things we can do as legislators is to have a sense of where we are, where we've been, and where we're going. So, Commissioner Showalter, I'm not sure if you're going to start out, or we just turn over to Dr. Stinson, whatever you'd like to do.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter. Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, with me is Dr. Tom Stinson, state economist. And also in the audience is Margaret Kelly, state budget director. We're going to present you with an abbreviated version of our forecast and sort of updated information on the economy and issues that are relevant to the Tax and Finance Committees. We are going to try and keep this to about a half hour, 45 minutes, so that we have enough time to have Commissioner Franz come up and talk about, have his presentation as well. And I think it will be a really good combination because, really, we have spent weeks and months on preparing budget recommendations. We're still working on that with the governor and are looking forward to presenting those on January 22nd. But if we don't have a common understanding of the risks, the issues, the environment that we're trying to work from, now, those recommendations, it's going to take a long time to come to some conclusion and understand where we're trying to go. So this really forms the baseline for Minnesota's financial situation and the operating environment that we have to deal with. I mean, in short, we still have a $1.1 billion deficit, and that is going to be really a continuing challenge for the state. It's formed by a continuing imbalance between our revenues and expenditures and dates back to the budget solution from 2 years ago, where we had used one-time measures in order to balance and resolve the 12 and 13 spending levels, but one-time solutions do not continue. So movements of money from other funds into the general fund artificially increased our revenues. We also decreased our revenues artificially through other one-time things. That leaves us with about a $1.1 billion gap in the shifts yet as well, that we have a repayment of our school shifts that remain to be taken care of. We had good news in November, though, that we were able to draw that down significantly because of economic news and because of increased collections. We were able to pay $1.3 billion back at that point in time. I think the important thing for the Finance and the Tax Committees to know, though, is that we're not seeing that short-term improvement carry into 14 and 15, and that as of the November forecast, there are a number of factors that you need to know about, but they do not suggest that we're going to simply grow our way out of this problem, and that there are certain risks, primarily with the federal government, that we still need to address, and at least account for, because even as I'm driving in, I'm hearing another discussion about ceiling crisis and other risks, and that's the difficult operating and estimating environment that we're working in. When we released the November forecast, Dr. Stinson said, and I think correctly, that the upside and downside risks to this forecast were significant, and I think that remains the case. I'm going to walk through just a couple quick slides to give you the overview of where we are on the budget numbers. And you'll see here that higher numbers, higher revenues, and lower spending created that 2012 and 13 balance. Most of it was on the revenue side, about $1.76 billion increased revenues, higher than expected. Dr. Stinson will talk about some of those revenues as we go through it. Those were augmented by unexpected one-time events. Increased collections on federal matching funds due to improved reporting on the SWIFT system, getting more than I think is $130 million. These kinds of things improved and all kind of worked for the state and helped us to repay the shift down to about an 80-20 level. The reserves have been largely replenished to the $988 million level. And as a result of current law, we start this budget process with a zero available balance in 12 and 13. That's been a long-standing practice. I think you all are pretty familiar with it, but I want to just underscore it again. That law makes sure that in good times, we first put money into the reserves, second, use that money to start paying back the shift. And why that's really an important tool, and a surprising tool, I think, from the rating agency perspective, is that it really gets us back on our financial feet as fast as possible. So that rather than metering it out over time, we make sure that the first dollar goes in, and that $1.3 billion that we put in at this forecast is, I think, a significant improvement in that shift number. The small change in 14-15, really, when we left the last legislative session, we anticipated a $1.1 billion gap for this upcoming budget biennium, and that is essentially still the case. Small changes in revenues and spending ultimately balance out to that $1.1 billion figure. One of the questions that came up recently was whether we're going to be growing our way out of this budget challenge, and Dr. Stinson can address that directly. But certainly, we've had good news for the last three forecasts, and that hasn't been enough to move us into a structural balance. We still have a significant challenge even after we've made incremental gains in the economy and short-term revenue increases. You'll see here some of the changes that have occurred during that period of time. But I think really this is one of those long-standing discussions that we have in this committee, and that is the structural balance of our spending obligations and our revenues. And for the tax committee side, I just point out that much of the spending is virtually 88% of the spending is in four areas. It's not, the general fund spending is between K-12, health and human services, local aids and credits, and higher education. If you account for those four areas, you got 88 to 89% of the total state budget. You toss in your debt service, you're over 90%. So the question of balancing and the question of how our spending growth is going to occur or not occur is very closely tied into those issues. With that background and sort of the budget challenge that we have ahead, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Stinson. We've got, as I suggested, a number of very topical questions right now about the federal fiscal cliff, the debt ceiling, and turn it over to him to talk about the state economy and our revenue projections.
Dr. Stinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to spend a little bit of time just on the highlights. We can go into the details of the revenue forecast, November's revenue forecast, if you'd like, but the details are going to change in a month and a half. On February 28th, we're going to issue a new forecast, and it will be different because there have been institutional changes that have occurred that will affect the forecast, and there may be more institutional changes that occur again. You turn to page.
Dr. Stinson, could either, I don't know if the mic is working or if you could.
Is that there? Yes, that's better. I just need to be closer. This slide that's on the screen here shows what happened both in 2012, 2013, and 2014, 2015 revenues. In 2012, 2013, we added $1,076 million in revenue. $709 million of that was in the individual income, sales, and corporate income taxes, that's about a 2.6% growth in there. Most of the money in the income tax came from the capital gains, changes in the assumptions that we made. When we made the February forecast, we were not assuming that there would be a change in the capital gains rate associated with the Affordable Care Act. We knew that under the Affordable Care Act, the rate was going to change. We're going to go from that there's going to be an additional 3.8% surtax on unearned income for individuals with high incomes. But because that was in the courts, we felt it prudent not to make that adjustment in our models and not have that additional revenue that we thought would be generated come in. By November, the courts had decided what was actually going on was constitutional, and so at that point we made that change. That changed the growth rate in capital gains that we have in the forecast from a 16% growth rate last February to a 59% growth rate for tax year 2012. That made a noticeable impact on the revenues for tax year 2013 because we assumed, and our models show that what happens is that people accelerate gains into the lower tax year to reduce the tax bill. So that boosts revenues for tax year 2012, fiscal year 2013. And reduces revenues in tax year 2013, fiscal year 2014. We now have a 49% decline in capital gains receipts in tax year 2013. Since that time, since the time that we did the forecast, the capital gains environment has changed again. As part of the agreement reached between the President and Congress, the capital gains rate on high-income individuals goes from 15 to 20%. So that means that if you sold stock on December 30th of 2012, you would pay 15% tax on it. If you sell it January 14th, you will pay 23.8% on it. And so we believe that change in the tax law that change in the tax rate will encourage or encouraged people to realize more gain in tax year 2012. So we would expect to see more income in fiscal year 2013 than we had in the forecast, and less in 2014 and 2015. One other item that stands out on this slide is the $548 million decline in the forecast for 14 and 15. Only about half of that is due to capital gains. The other half is due to slower wage growth than we had thought at the time. The final item I want to point out to you is the other revenue for 14 and 15 is up $219 million. $130 million of that is simply a change in the treatment of tobacco revenue. Again, when we went from the tobacco bonds to appropriation bonds, the tobacco revenue came back into the general fund, and so we add all that back in, but that's offset by expenditures for debt service on the tobacco bonds. The next slide is out of date. I left it in there because it's indicative of the concern that we have. This slide shows what would have happened in our forecast had we've gone over the fiscal cliff, and you can see the big drop in the dotted line there in 2013, and then a slow recovery. We have a three-quarter recession. Unemployment in Minnesota goes to 7.1% from 5.3%. Personal income declines by about 4%. And our estimates were that revenues would fall by $1.7 billion in 2014-2015. Well, that's all been taken care of, but in the genre of economic forecasting, we have another scary story for you to bring up. It seems like that federal fiscal policy issues are just one scary story after another. And the scary story that we have is what everybody knows is the debt ceiling. Let me start out by saying that almost everybody believes this is not going to happen, that the Congress and the President will reach some kind of an agreement to extend and raise the debt ceiling by probably $2 trillion, which will get us through the next 2 years and get that done sometime between February 15th and March 15th. But if it does happen, if we don't extend the debt ceiling, then most economists believe that this will be worse than the fiscal cliff would have been had we gone off the fiscal cliff. The problem is that we don't have good quantification of the impacts. The fiscal cliff, we knew what the dollar amounts were, and you could put those in the models, and it was relatively easy to simulate the impact of the fiscal cliff. Here, the real risk is a risk of a credit crunch. It's the effect of the change in the treatment of federal credits and how that affects the banking system, how that affects the global financial system. And certainly there's a possibility if the U.S. Treasuries are downgraded, and it's very likely, it's almost a certainty that if we don't extend the debt ceiling, that U.S. Treasuries will be downgraded. And that's expected to produce a kind of a a global credit freeze and credit unavailability, not just in the U.S., but throughout the world. You know, I don't want to sound alarmist here, and I don't want to make this seem like it's something that is going to happen or anything like that, but there certainly is a risk to this situation. Both Fitch and Moody's, the two rating agencies that have that currently rate the U.S. Treasuries as a AAA credit, have said that just extending the debt ceiling isn't enough for a country to be a AAA credit, that there has to be noticeable progress towards stabilizing the debt as a proportion of GDP as well. And when that progress has to be made is left unsaid, but there is certainly the possibility of a downgrade. Further downgrade of U.S. Treasuries creates a problem because a number of financial institutions have covenants with their investors saying that they have to have a certain amount of their assets in AAA-rated credits. And if U.S. Treasuries are no longer AAA-rated credits, that would lead a rush to get out the door, and it could be a very messy situation in there. So that's the concern. Moving on to the next slide. This is just a slide of capital gains and what we're forecasting in capital gains. You can see the 59% in 2012. You can see the minus 50% in 2013. And again, there are going to be changes in both of those due to the solution to the fiscal cliff. A couple of days ago, we announced some good news, and that was that our November and December revenue collections exceeded forecast, and exceeded forecast by a significant amount. We're now showing for the months of November and December revenues $114 million, or 3.9% above forecast. Now, I want to tell you that you can't multiply 55 or 57, which would be the monthly rate, by 8 months and say by the end of the biennium we're going to be $400 million plus more than we would have had in there. Some of this is one time. Some of it is really timing, and we have sometimes problems meeting out the timing compared to prior years on processing of estimated payments and things like that. But still, this is good news.
Sales.
The biggest concern is the sales tax. Sales tax gross receipts were down more than $20 million. For sales that occurred in the month of November, which was the first part of the Christmas shopping season. There's new data that's out today that says that consumer spending was up 0.5% in the month of December, but a lot of that was things that was on things that we don't collect sales tax on directly. On autos, on gasoline, on pharmaceuticals. And so we'll have to see how things are going. The big item that added to the forecast is corporate taxes. Part of that is due to some audit activity, but about $75 million of it is just due to corporations paying higher estimated payments in the fourth quarter than we expected. In fact, they paid higher estimated payments than ever in history, and the change between this year and last year was the highest in history as well. Without the corporate, and the corporate is always a question because corporate tax managers aren't necessarily best cash flow individuals. Without the corporate, we're still, though, up $37 million. One final slide here shows the effect on Global Insight's forecast of the solution to the fiscal cliff. What you see is that the first quarter of 2013, the quarter that we're in now, growth rate has been reduced and reduced noticeably. It's 1%. It was 2.4% prior. Then after that, there's a slight, kind of overall, a slight decline until 2015, but nothing big. In November, the forecast was for 1.9% real growth in 2013. Now the forecast is for 1.7% growth. In 2014, it was for 2.8%. Now it's 2.7%. And for 2015, it's 3.3%, and now it's 3.4%. So there's really not a lot of change, and not a lot of change in the underlying economic forecast at this time. We'll have another forecast before we actually do the revenue forecast in February. We'll see how that comes out. At this point, Global Insight is assuming that there will be no default, that the Congress and the President will get together to raise the debt ceiling in there as well. But we'll see what they're assuming on that. With that, let me turn it back over to the Commissioner.
Well, Dr. Stinson, maybe before we leave you, we could just, Commissioner, if it's okay, just ask a couple questions. Dr. Stinson, there have been talk about an expanding economy. What's the reason for the leveling off of the GDP?
I guess I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Well, you've indicated that there's a slight diminishment in the GDP growth,
okay,
from where we were or what was projected. So what's the reason for that?
There are a couple of reasons. One is that consumer spending just seems to be a little bit weaker. What we're seeing with November sales tax receipts, where they were under forecast compared to what we have, we expect to see that in December and January as well. So consumer spending is weaker than was forecast. The second thing is that business investment, it's probably because of the uncertainty in the economy. First the fiscal cliff, now this question of the extension of the debt ceiling or the increase in the debt ceiling. If you're a corporate CEO, you may not be comfortable making big commitments for business investment, for expanding your productive capacity, if you aren't sure how we're going to come out of this debt ceiling issue. You always have the opportunity to look down the road and say, why don't I wait a month? Why don't I wait 2 months? Why don't I wait 3 months? So that I don't make a mistake. These are irreversible investments, and if you make a mistake, it's going to cost you and build a plant and we go into a recession, it's going to cost you some money, and so you're better off, in a lot of instances, and a lot of people would think they would be better off by just waiting till there's more certainty in the situation before the solutions resolve themselves a little bit better. So there's that. There's also still the problems in Europe. There's not really much growth in the global economy, so exports are not expected to do as well as they have had been as well. So all of those keep the economy growing at well below the normal 2.5 to 3% that you would see in normal times. But if you look at the chart, the one that's titled Slower Real GDP, or the one that's on the screen, what you see is that we begin to start coming up, and that 2013 is progressively stronger, and 2014 is above 3% growth rate on a quarterly basis in there. And so what that what's expected is that both the business investment side resolves itself, and there's more more certainty, and also that the housing industry begins to perk up a little bit more as well.
Okay, and your answer was part of your answer was my second question. That was the dip in sales tax revenues as a consequence of a less than expected Christmas season, but it sounds like you expect that to continue. Is that consumer confidence has leveled off, and is that a consequence of economic reasons or maybe just political reasons with what's going on at a federal level?
Mr. Chairman, uncertainty is caused by some of the political situations that we have now, but uncertainty is a real economic concern. And if you're not confident as a consumer, you're not going to be spending quite as much as you would have before. Now, this first quarter of 2013, part of the reason why consumer spending is down there as well is because part of the solution to the fiscal cliff debate was to eliminate the payroll tax cut, move the payroll tax back up to 6% from 4%. So that takes money out of the consumer's pocket, and that would slow the economy down beginning in the first quarter, beginning right now.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, you've talked about the uncertainty, and the Congress has resolved part of it by the actions that they took at the end of the year. But they also, as you mentioned, left 2 months from now the debt ceiling debate. You talked about an ongoing series of these issues that are fueling some of this uncertainty. When you forecast, what is your expectation? Are you leaving those uncertainties unresolved, or are you expecting them to be resolved to get the growth that you're demonstrating in 14 and 15?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Schoen, Global Insight provides us with a national macroeconomic forecast, and we tend to follow their lead in what's being assumed. They're assuming that these uncertainties are resolved on a timely basis, maybe not completely, but that the uncertainties begin to be wiped away, and that we get more nearly on a steady path to resolving the debt situation, for example, by 2014. Now, as Senator Cohen knows, we meet with a panel of local economists before we do the forecast. And we use them as a check against Global Insight's assumptions. We would hate for Global Insight to be the only person, the only group not forecasting a recession, for example, and kind of go blindly over the cliff because we didn't have an independent check. And so we have this independent check, and we will talk with our Council of Economic Advisors about this as well, the end of January and in early February, and make our decisions based on that as well. But, you know, at this time, frankly, I don't think we're going to know what's going to happen on the debt ceiling at the time we do the forecast, because Global Insights forecast will come out the first week in February. By President's Day, we will be having to make all our decisions on the revenues, the state revenues, and if past history is any indication, it's unlikely that Congress and the President reach agreement on the debt ceiling until the last minute, which is probably going to be around the time that we release the forecast. So while I think that there will be a solution, there's always a risk that there won't be a solution, and we'll probably know that there wasn't a solution about the time that we released the forecast.
So, Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson, so we'll get the forecast, but by the time we are approaching the end of session, we will be able to ascertain how they have resolved it and then make some assumptions about whether we will actually meet this growth. And if they don't resolve it as well as we would hope, those growth numbers will be lower. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, that's correct. We will have much better, if the debt ceiling problem becomes a real problem, you'll know before the end of the session. It appears that beginning toward the end of February and maybe in early March, and all of this is kind of iffy because it depends upon both how revenues flow into the Federal Treasury and what they do in terms of stopping the flow out of there. One of the things that certainly can be done and is likely to be done to buy a little bit more time is not pay individual income tax refunds and corporate income tax refunds. That in between February 15th and March 15th, that's estimated to provide about $85 billion worth of additional cash for the federal government, which is a little bit more than half of, and would make up a little bit more than half of the shortfall that would occur during that time. So there are things that can be done even after the extraordinary measures have been taken that can extend things out. But certainly by mid-March, you're going to know whether the debt ceiling is going to be a major concern or not. And by if it's a major concern by mid-March, by the 1st of April, everybody's going to be well aware of the problem, and you're going to be hearing about it.
One final thing. Just a comment, I guess, and you can tell me if you think I'm accurate. I've only heard your presentations a few times, but often you will talk about the percentage of the chance of an upside or a downside. And when I look at this graph and listen to what you just say, it sounds to me like the percentage of not hitting these is greater than the percentage of actually overachieving. Do you have a feel for that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, Global Insight provides provides three scenarios, what they call a baseline scenario, a scenario that's more optimistic, and a scenario that's more pessimistic. The probability assigned to a more pessimistic scenario than this is 20%, and so probability of doing this well or better is seen as 80%. Now, this is the same probability that existed in November, and one of our council members, Dan Laufenberg, who used to be the chief economist for Ameriprise, said that he was comfortable with the forecast, but he wasn't comfortable with the probabilities assigned to it. He said he thought it was he was a lot more comfortable with 30%, 40%, and 30%, that there are big probabilities on each end. We could do better, we could do worse, we could also do about the same, but it's much less one of these sharp bell-shaped curves and more flatter kind of a thing. So, again, it's easy to sound alarmist, and I don't want to sound alarmist here, but I do want you to be aware that there are significant risks in there. I think that Global Insights forecast probabilities are probably about right in there, but there is a big penalty if we go on the pessimistic side.
Thank you.
Further questions for Dr. Stinson? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stinson. I'm sorry, Senator Limmer. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stinson, your discussion is kind of focused on whether or not Congress raises their debt ceiling by $2 trillion, but that there's another option, and maybe that's just as unrealistic maybe at this time, is whether or not Congress could cut spending. And I don't know if there's a will in Congress to do that any more than there's a will to raise the debt ceiling, but if neither case happens, you kind of laid out an idea of good to bad of what could happen, or maybe bad to worse what could happen. How dependent are we on the federal budget as a state? I know that we do have a significant portion of what's spent by government in the state of Minnesota, but if that does not occur by the federal government, I suppose it's up to us as policymakers to try and decide, are we going to try and make up that difference? Can we even make up that difference? The effect of taxation to make up that difference might be causing a total collapse of a state economy. And so have you given any discussion on that scenario of what would happen?
Mr. Chairman, I think you've asked maybe three questions, and so
yeah,
let me
Dr. see if Sinsen, I can if you work, just focus on the last one, how do we compensate?
Let me just real briefly say something about what I understood to be the first question, which is cutting spending an alternative? And the answer is, in the short term, and this is really the short term, cutting spending is not an alternative. That you'd have to cut more than 40% of federal spending immediately in order to do that, and that's just not something that you can do. And so we have to have an increase in the debt ceiling. That can be. Okay, with respect to the importance of the federal money on the Minnesota economy, there are two things I'd say. One is that the Minnesota economy is part of the U.S. economy. Minnesota firms provide goods into the national marketplace, so that if the U.S. goes into a recession, that will certainly affect Minnesota. The second thing is that if you look at Minnesota's governments in Minnesota's reliance on federal spending, Minnesota's economy and Minnesota governments are less reliant on federal spending than almost every state, that we are more of a net contributor to the federal budget than a net taker away. I mean, if given the size of the deficits, everybody takes more away than they put in, but the gain for Minnesota is less on a proportional basis. That said, one place where the state is at risk is in the Medicaid area. And if you have a solution with respect to Medicaid, that could certainly provide some problems for the state and the state's budget. Now, if I remember right, that's discussed more in the forecast book, and I know Budget Director Kelly is here and is more versed on that than I am, and so she could explain more of it to you, but I think that that's the big risk is a change in the Medicaid program, and the Medicaid match rate is a place where we would see the biggest potential risk.
Okay. Senator Britson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, a question that I have is, and maybe I missed it, I'm sorry I stepped out of the room, but the corporate tax revenues that came in at 52.5%, could you run through that one more time as to why that happened in light of the fact of the uncertainty you talked about later of businesses probably not wanting to spend money? Can you tell me why the corporate situation is higher, the estimated $177 million. We actually brought in $270 million. And then I have one more short question for Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the short answer is that we can explain part of it because of, and it's due to some audit activity that went on. But that's a relatively small piece of it. That the largest piece of it is unprecedented increase in fourth quarter estimated tax payments by calendar year, fiscal year filers. We have found out that other states are seeing the same kind of action, but nobody really has a good explanation as to why, and this is something that we'll be looking at in the next couple of weeks, going and checking and seeing, you know, what kinds of firms made much larger payments, trying to figure out if there was something unusual in people's thinking about resolution of the fiscal cliff. I mean, these are payments that had to have been made by December 15th, and so people didn't know how the fiscal cliff was going to be resolved, so there may have been something that was going on there. And this is obviously an area that we're very interested in and going to pay a lot of attention to in the forecast. And so in a month and a half, I'll be able to answer your question a little better.
Thank you. Thank you. And Senator, excuse me, Mr. Chair, real quickly from the commissioner.
Well, we're going to hear from him in a minute. Is it possible to just?
Sure. It's just a question. It's just off the second slide is all.
Okay. If we could hold our question for Commissioner Showalter and finish with Dr. Stinson, Senator Reiner.
I'll wait, Mr. Chair. I think my two questions are, can't see, got the tall Jeremy Miller right in front of me. I think my two questions are probably for Commissioner Showalter, related to the AAA bond rating and the tobacco bond. So if that's the case, I will wait.
All right. So other questions for Dr. Stinson? Okay. Thank you, Dr. Stinson. Commissioner Showalter?
Okay. Before I go on to the last couple of slides, I'll go to the second slide. Is this the slide here? Mr. Chair, Senator?
Mr. Chair?
Sir,
am I supposed to ask the question?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. With regards to the school shift payback, mm-hmm. just the year, the level of dollars that we were at, was it 1990 you said right now?
The payment shift is basically a little bit better than 80-20 right now. So 80% of the entitlement is paid in the first year, 20% settle up. That was improved from... I can check my numbers, but it's around 67% previously.
Thank you for that. I'm sorry. What the 1.324, is that at what level was that? You had mentioned a year level on that, and I missed it. We're at what level? I mean, what?
What do we still owe?
That we still owe, exactly.
Oh, we still owe
yes,
1.1
I'm sorry.
Billion.
I'm sorry?
So we still have $1.1 billion.
Yes, and what level was that? You said 19-something or other, the year that we were at that level. That's what I'm looking
for. Oh, I think you – 19. I think you may be misheard because I was saying a 90-10 is sort of the normal payment shift, basically payment split between 90 and 10. 90% in the first year, 10% in the settle-up payment. We're at about a little over 80-20 right now. So there's two pieces that need to be repaid at this point, is to settle up that aid payment shift as well as a property tax recognition shift. Those are the two remaining pieces that we need to get back. They show on our financials as well as this budget discussion. So also when we talk with rating agencies, that's part of our discussion of whether, you know, the state has a net positive financial position or a net negative financial position. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll just conclude our presentation quickly. As we just started, we have a $1.1 billion challenge ahead for the 2014-15 budget year. The comparisons will come as we all try to get into the budget numbers, understanding what's going on and what's happening. I would just also underscore working with the fiscal staff as you try to do those things, because as Dr. Stinson stated in his presentation, as I said at the beginning, there's a number of one-time actions that change both the level and the comparison points between 12 and 13, 14 and 15, even fiscal 10 and 11. Things like the payment shift, the repayment of the shift, tobacco bonds, and the change in the nature of the tobacco bonds, the use of one-time funds from other funds to help resolve the 12 and 13 budget. There's a number of moving pieces, and certainly comparisons are not easy, even though we are all trying to make that and understand sort of the context of where we're going. This last slide is something that Minnesota has been doing for many years, which is to take a longer view of our budget, to see the trends and what's happening. And I'm pleased to say that over time, by 2016 and 17, the spending and revenue lines start to converge. But that is in part raising a different issue, which is also the fact that inflation is included in our revenue numbers and it's not included in our spending numbers. So there is clearly a structural issue that is here that we need to focus on. And I think the building blocks for a better budget are in place with the growing economy and I think the resources in the state. But we have some tough decisions to make here, as does Congress. As the state in the past enjoyed a AAA rating. We lost that. And it's going to take a number of years to regain that. One of the first steps we can do is to pass a balanced budget, to get our structural balance into place, and to get this out longer-term outlook so that we are structurally balanced for the future. That concludes our presentation. Be happy to take any additional questions.
Sir Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you touched on both questions, and maybe I'll ask the second one first since you just discussed it. But you said first step in restoring our AAA bond rating, which, of course, allows us to borrow money at a lower interest rate, save the taxpayers money. What other steps would be required? And then, Mr. Chair, I have a follow-up question regarding the tobacco bond.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would cite two different things. One is something that everyone here very directly participates in, and that is just the what one of the rating agencies called gridlock in Minnesota, and that is to move our decision-making process forward in a thoughtful, timely manner. The shutdown of 2 years ago impaired our reputation, and certainly over years we've had difficulty managing things on a timely basis. That's a critical element in restoring our longstanding reputation as a well-managed state and ability to respond to questions. I think the second thing is replenishing and increasing our reserves and restoring the shifts that we've made over time so that the state has the wherewithal to withstand with shocks as they go along. The economy and the federal government will come and it will go, but our part of that, in which the rating agencies look at, is our ability to manage that. And so long as we have thin reserves or under-sourced reserves, or that we have outstanding obligations, our ability to manage is diminished. So those would be two key steps.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I remember reading the reports at the time, but at the moment I don't recall if they addressed sort of the unbalanced revenue mix that has developed over time.
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. But by unbalanced, I would say that they don't necessarily, in my experience, watch the balance of the revenue mix so much as our ability to manage within that and the ability to manage the volatility of it. You know, there's always a choice that states can make, but if you take a very volatile revenue mix, then you have to have a much larger set of reserves and a much different set of financial plan.
Senator Ryder.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Switching topics to the tobacco bond, just two specific questions. If we were to pay it off today, what would it cost us to do that? And if we were to let it run its full 20 years, how much would we pay in interest?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can get you those specific numbers. Certainly the payoff's in the order of $700 million. I'm not sure the life cycle of those bonds. Certainly we have that and can provide that to you. The interest rates that we are paying on those bonds was significantly reduced when they became appropriation bonds, both because of the nature of that credit and also because of the nature of the interest rate environment that we're in right now. But I certainly can provide that to you.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm interested in the reserves. And I know that I believe they were at zero. I understand now that they've been replenished. And according to NASBO, they're at 6.5%. Is that your numbers in 2012? And projected to be 9.3% in 2013? That's the National Association of State Budget Offices. But my question is, you can tell me about those numbers, but then my question is, I'd really like to hear your thoughts on increasing our reserve level. I think statutorily it's at 5% right now. And I'd like to know your thoughts on, perhaps our credit rating and also just good management about increasing that reserve level.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd be happy to respond. I think the numbers that you're referring to, probably NASBO took our reserve level and assumed it was on an annual basis, so that rather than, as we look at it, we've worked on a biennial basis, and so typically our reserves are compared against the biennial budget rather than, because that's the risk that they have to cover, rather than an annual budget.
Thank you.
So I'm guessing that that's the difference of what we're talking about. The Council of Economic Advisors would suggest a more significant budget reserve, and in fact, the legislature has required a report of MMB to estimate the kinds of reserves necessary based upon the Budget Trends Commission. I think that report's going to be coming out even today. Those numbers would be significantly larger than the roughly $1 billion that we have between budget reserve and cash flow accounts right now. $1.5 billion, $1.7 billion would be kind of the range that we would be talking about. That would certainly be a positive in terms of the state's cash position's ability to manage risk over time. And it's something that we should try to get to over time. I think the first order of business is, again, repaying some of the debts that are out there on the payments to K-12. But I think our long-term financial plan should include addressing those reserves, because the volatility in the economy, the volatility of revenues, is something that is going to continue, and reserves are our first line of defense against that.
Thank you, Dr. Stinson. Commissioner Showalter, if you gentlemen would be willing to, Commissioner, just scoot over, and Commissioner Franz, if you could come forward, give us your, if you, well, if they could stick around in case there's some questions at the end of the hearing. We're kind of cutting the questions just a little bit short here, but if you'd be willing to. And Commissioner Franz, Senator Ingebrigtsen asked the question about that I was curious about. If there's some tax policy that is driving some of those corporate decisions that you're aware of, maybe you can talk a little bit about that in your presentation. So, Commissioner Franz. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Scoia and Chairman Cohen, for inviting me here today. And I'm happy to be in front of all of you for this opportunity just to deal with that question right away Senator Ingebrigtsen had. We've been studying that as well. And as Dr. Stinson mentioned, there's a small part of it that's related to audit activity. But we don't know yet what the other portion of that of the acceleration of corporate revenue is for 2012. So we'll be looking into that along with MMB. We don't have the answers to that yet. With that, what I would like to do is one of the things that Chair Scoia asked me to do was to talk a little bit about what I've been doing recently in terms of a conversation I've been having with Minnesotans about the tax policy. And unlike Dr. Stinson, he has a much more difficult job looking into the future. What we've really been doing a lot in this presentation is looking at the past, the trends, and how did we get to where we are. And so what I'm going to do is I've got a slideshow that some of you have seen. I'll go through it fairly quickly so that we can have some time for questions at the end. But I wanted to give you a sense of what I've been talking to Minnesotans about. Many of you have had the opportunity to attend, or maybe it's not an opportunity, but to attend one of these sessions. And I really appreciate that, to share your community and to share this dialogue in your various communities, because it's been very helpful for me. One of the things that we've been trying to do, and we always, it's always a great place to start, is talking about Minnesota, what a great state it is. And I think we could go on and on about that. But I think the key is we're working from strength in Minnesota, and we want to continue to go towards strength. One of the things that tax reform has been one of Governor Dayton's three priorities. His first priority has been to create jobs, improve the Minnesota's competitiveness. He also wants to improve how we deliver government services, and he also wanted to make sure we have a sustainable budget and tax reform. So as I've gone around the state, one of the things that I wanted to show you where I've been, to show you that this has been a very long process. We really started this in October of 2011 when the governor had his job summit here in St. Paul. At that point, we decided, well, let's talk about what should we put on the table. If we're going to discuss tax reform, what are the issues that we should discuss? And the idea was, well, let's put everything on the table and let's have a real discussion. Let's find out what everybody, what their concerns are and what they think the problems are, and let's go around and ask people. Well, in the process since last October of 2011, I've been to over 50 different cities, had over 162 meetings about this particular topic, and 84 different legislators have shown up in these different meetings, attended these meetings, and participated in these meetings. We've talked to over 7,000 people. We also had one advisory group that you may be aware of, and that was a mayor's advisory group. We asked 15 mayors from across the state to help us on local government aid and property taxes as they affect city government because of the particular unique problems that cities have with respect to some of those issues. And I'll tell you at the end, when we have a few minutes, about what I heard while I was traveling around the state. But the key question that we have for all of you in this session is, why should we worry about Minnesota's tax system and why should we worry about it now? One of the concerns we have is that it's gotten out of date. We simply need to modernize it in some ways. We think it's out of balance, that we're not getting the right revenues from the right sources. We think it could be more fair and making sure that everyone pays their fair share. We think it's clearly too complex, and I'm sure all of you have had complaints from citizens about the complexity of the tax code. And the other thing is, we want to try to decide should we pick winners and losers, or should we be picking winners or losers? Or might it be better for us to get out of that process and level the playing field as much as we can, reduce the rate as much as we can, and let everyone pay the same rate? So one of the things when we first started talking about the Minnesota tax code changing, and that is about the revenue system. You've heard Dr. Stinson and Commissioner Showalter talk about the volatility that we have in some of our revenue streams. Well, you can see the volatility from our economy. A lot of you know that we had a wonderful increase in jobs before the recession hit us. We had a 4.7% increase in jobs, but unfortunately we lost 5.6% of those jobs during the Great Recession. Now we're coming back and we're continually improving our economy and our jobs, but not quickly enough and not as much as we'd like to. But this next slide really shows you the volatility of the revenue stream as it relates to the economy. When we had that increase in jobs of 4.7%, we had a 5% uptick in sales tax revenue. When the jobs went down during the recession, we had a 9% drop in sales tax revenue, even more so on the income side. When we had the increasing jobs, clearly income tax is going to go up, more people are employed. When we lose jobs, the revenue stream is going to slow down. In corporate income tax, even more so, we had a 92% increase in corporate tax revenue as we had the increase in jobs before 2008. And after 2008, during the recession, we saw a 46% decrease in revenue from corporate income tax. All these really show the importance of a strong, vibrant economy where we're having jobs being created. But also taxes are part of the issue and part of the story that people look at when they're out in the community. And one of this is, how much money are we spending at state and local levels? What is our level of investment at the state and local side? Minnesota has been known as having a relatively high state and tax local revenue as a percent of personal income, or a cost of government, if you will, or price of government. One of the things we've noticed in the last decade, for 7 out of the last 8 years, Minnesota is now spending below the U.S. average when it comes to state and local tax revenue as a percent of personal income. So we've really seen a marked change in the amount of money that we're spending at the state and local revenue area. Another thing we've looked at, the trends in terms of jobs, we compare Minnesota's per capita income rank to the other 50 states, and we've seen a tremendous increase. This is a great success story. Back in the 1950s, we were in the middle of the pack when it came to our per capita income rank to the other 50 states, and we made it all the way to being number 7 in the United States. Now, this has come down a little bit since 2004. This is another one of those questions that we're studying. Why are the jobs that we're creating in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years not as high-paying as they were before? This is something we need to look at and we need to study. But clearly, Minnesota per capita income ranking is something we really want to make sure that we work on, because when we create jobs, we really want to create good-paying jobs. This is a slide that really is one of the issues about modernization. Back in the 1950s, which I can remember, unfortunately, most of the consumer spending was for consumer goods, not for services. Now you can see in 2010, that's completely flipped, and our economy has really become a service-based economy. 67% of consumer spending relates to services, not goods. As you know, in Minnesota, our tax code taxes goods and taxes very few services. On the e-commerce side, we've seen a continual erosion in the amount of sales tax that we collect from those folks who are selling from outside the state into Minnesota. And there's two components of this. One component of this is the federal tax law that requires a business to have a store or to have employees in the state before they have what we call nexus. And if they don't have nexus, then they don't have to collect the local sales tax when they're selling into a state. Well, that accounts for a large part of this problem, where companies are not required to collect sales taxes for sales into Minnesota. Yet, at the same time, all those stores in your hometowns and in your districts, they are collecting sales tax. We think it's a matter of fairness. We have proposed one fix that we can do at the local level in Minnesota, and that is what we call the affiliate nexus, where we can require those companies like Amazon that have what we call affiliates or sponsors in the state actually selling on their behalf, we can require them to actually collect sales tax. That's only about a $5 million a year issue. This is really a $400 million a year issue. Now, every state has the same slide. It's just that they have a different number at the bottom in terms of how much money is being lost. So this is something that Congress needs to fix, and we're very supportive of this, and we would hope you would be as well. We hear a lot about whether our system is competitive or not, and we've had those discussions in this room many different times, and it really depends on how you're comparing Minnesota to other states. Many studies will take a look at our statutory rate, and for example, our 9.8% corporate rate is the third or fourth highest in the country. And clearly, when you compare that statutory rate to other states, we're not going to compare very well. On the other hand, if you look at the effective rate, what is the actual tax rate paid by most Minnesota companies? Well, it's something much less than 9.8%. And that's why, if you look on the left side of the slide, Ernst & Young did a study in around the country in 2011, and they tried to look at what do companies actually pay in their effective rate when they make an investment in a state. And they looked at the investment for like a plant. And they found that Minnesota, in terms of the lowest effective tax rate, ranked number 10 in terms of having the 10th lowest effective rate for actual investments. So we have this dichotomy where we have these high statutory rates, a lot of deductions or credits, and we have a lower effective rate. So it makes it difficult for us to really compare ourselves. And we all have to remember that we do get compared to other states based on that statutory rate. One of the things that's really coming that we all are dealing with in all your committees, I'm sure you're dealing with the demographic changes that are coming in one way or another. And this is really coming right at us. If you look at this growth over the next 28 years, you'll see that 1.2 million more people will be in the state of Minnesota, but 850,000 more will be over the age of 60. Now, I'm going to be in that group at the end. At least I hope I'm here at the end of this chart. But the key is, if you look at the growth or the lack of growth in those deciles, age deciles on the left, it really points out the importance of our young people, the importance of our education system. the importance of making sure that we have workers and students and young people who can take on these new jobs as we go forward. We need to keep our young people here. We need to attract more young people because they're the ones who will be filling these jobs in the future. As Dr. Stinson pointed out to me the other day, I'm going to be a job creator in the next 5 to 10 years when I retire, and a lot of us are going to be job creators because we're going to be creating opportunities for young people.
Oh.
But this slide shows you how important that particular issue is. Now, from an income tax standpoint, the reason I have that slide in there is for this one. This simply shows us what's the average income that you pay by age decile. And this is back in 2007. But the point is, you tend to pay your highest income taxes in your highest income earning years. And those tend to be in your 30s, your 40s, and your 50s. Well, you can see with the other slide, if we move everybody over to the right side of this particular slide, we're going to have a lot of people who are seniors, who are slowing down or retiring and not paying as much income tax. So we have to look in the future and be concerned about the revenue source from our income taxes. We see another trend here that we wanted to point out, and that is a growing income disparity. In 2007, this is the United States slide, and this shows that now we have the top 10% in the United States earn 50% of the income each year. This is not a wealth measurement. This is simply how much income is earned each year and who earns that income. We've seen a study by the Pew Research Center. They, in August, issued this report. They follow how many people are in the middle income brackets or the lower income brackets or upper income. They've been studying this since 1971. And you can see that we've seen a 10% decrease in the amount of folks who are in the middle income range. Now, the real concern is obviously at the bottom, the increase of 4% in the lower income bracket. Clearly, we like it when we see people that go into the higher income area, but we're concerned about the growth in the lower income. Just for purposes of comparison, in 2011, that the red box at the bottom, the middle income box, the lower level there is about $41,000 for a family of four, and the upper level is about $137,000 a year for a family of four. Here's where we talk about the balance and our concern about the balance. For many, many years in Minnesota, the three primary sources, not the only sources, but the three primary sources of revenue in our general fund have been the property tax, the income tax, and the sales tax. Now, they're never exactly a third, and they change every year because of economy and what's going on. But we saw in 2010 when we took a look at this, I have sound effects. I don't have my three-legged stools today, but we did see in 2010 that the property tax rate had gone to 40% of the three, income tax was about at a third, and sales tax at 27%. So this is where we're concerned about how are we going to rely on these revenue sources for the future funding of our government. One of the things that we looked at is the sales tax. We projected that into the future, and even with economic growth, we found that the sales tax rate really wasn't going to grow much at all, and it's in part because of the narrow tax base we have in Minnesota, and I'll show you another slide about that in just a moment. We know that the property tax leg is the longest right now, and here's some of the things that have happened in the last 10 years. Now, this chart is adjusted for inflation and for population. So since 2002, we've seen about over 20% increase in property taxes statewide, and we've seen about 30% drop in local government state aid during that same time period. This is where we've seen our local communities, our cities, our townships, our schools, and our counties struggling with how do they deal with the lack of revenue coming from the state. And part of the issue has been to reduce services and or increase their levies. So that's where the property tax increases have come. Sales tax, here's what I mentioned earlier. We have a very small sales tax base, probably the smallest sales tax base in this area. We have the highest statewide sales tax rate. We have a 6.875 sales tax rate. The other states in this region have a lower tax rate than we do. So let's talk just briefly about who pays the income tax. As you know, every 2 years we do an incidence study, and we determine what's the incidence, who actually pays the taxes in Minnesota. Well, the first one we look at is income tax. And as you all know, the income tax is progressive, And this chart shows you what is the average household taxes paid in these 10 different income deciles in Minnesota. Now, if you look at property taxes, you can see that property taxes are fairly constant throughout the deciles, although it is regressive. You'll see on the left side that the property taxes go down a little bit in the lower deciles, and that's because of the property tax refund, the homeowner's credit, and the renter's credit refund. They ameliorate a little bit the property taxes for their lower income deciles. If you look at sales tax, we know that sales tax is regressive, and this is how it's spread out through our 10 deciles. And then if you look at other taxes, there are four different groups here: the property tax, sales tax, income tax, and other taxes. That includes corporate tax, motor fuels tax, cigarette taxes. These also are regressive. They're like excise taxes in a way. And so let's put them all together. And this is the result that we had in the last study, showing that those households in the middle pay about 12.3% of their income to these four taxes. The top 10% pay about 10.3%, and the top 2% pay about 9.7%. Now, I want to show you what we try to always do is show trends. So if you look at the trend, how has this burden been distributed over time? If you look back in 1990, the top 10% paid about 1.5% less than the other 90%. If you look over time, that's been increasing. And if you look in 2008, the top 10% pay about 16.6% less than the other 90% of Minnesota households. So this is the trend that we've been looking at since 1990. Just two more areas, and we can open it up for discussions. Complexity creep. You hear a lot about how complex our code has become. We go back to 1987, when that was one of the fewest deductions and credit numbers we had. We had 9 credits and adjustments in 1987. And in 2010, we have now 50. So our taxpayers have to deal with 50 different credits or adjustments now. Property taxes the same way. We see a continual increase in the number of property classes that we have to deal with. Really creates a lot of burden for people to understand how the system works. I'll give you a quick quiz and see if you're up to date on your sales tax. This has always been fun in the different communities. So if you buy a Bob Dylan album from a neighborhood record store, if you go in and buy the album — I actually do buy albums, by the way — but if you actually do buy an album, do you pay a sales tax to that album or not?
Yes.
Answer is sure. What if you take a digital download of that from the Internet, which I can't do either, by the way? Do you pay tax on a digital download? No, but we don't define digital downloads as goods in Minnesota. This is something that we could change in Minnesota. So we have that problem there where we really haven't modernized. Of course, I actually prefer vinyl, but that's another story. Does the sales tax apply to a book like The Master of the Senate from Robert Caro if you buy that from your neighborhood bookstore? So if you go in and buy a book, you pay sales tax, yes. How about if you buy that from Amazon online? Well, of course, no. And this is something else that we could fix with the affiliate nexus law, or this is something that Congress could fix. The two laws that are being considered in Congress would require a seller anywhere in the United States to collect a sales tax based on the destination of the product, so every state could collect the sales tax on those sales.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
By the way, that's an excellent book. I'm reading it right now on my Kindle. Didn't pay sales tax.
I bought the book, Senator, and I'm reading. Okay, this is one that a lot of people get have fun with. Does the sales tax apply to a Milky Way candy bar?
No.
Sure, it's not a food, it's a candy, and we don't tax candy, but not food. How about a Twix candy bar?
No.
Another candy bar? No, because this is one of these funny rules. This is one of these unintended sort of rules. Twix has enough flour in it to be classified as a food. So that's the problem. Now, the line here is a line with a good intention. We belong to the Streamlined Sales Agreement, where we try to have consistent definitions from one state to another state, and that's a good idea. This particular line is a little funny, though. So I've been saying this all around the state, and I'm sure Twix candy bar sales are up around the state these days.
Now that we know.
Finally, the last thing is, I want to mention our tax breaks and our concern about how much we spend on tax breaks. We have In 2010, for example, we collected $16 billion in revenue. We didn't collect, or we gave away, or we gave credits, deductions for about $11 billion. Now, there are a lot of things in there that are important, and I think dear to all of us, or at least some of us. But we had a report just several years ago where it was recommended that we take a look at these on a regular basis at a minimum and start looking at these and deciding, is that tax break in there for the right reason? Is it doing what we want it to do, and should it remain in there? So we really want to bring this to everyone's attention as something that we can all work together to look toward. I mean, another way to look at it is for every $60 that we can tax in Minnesota, 40 cents has already really been spoken for with the tax break or a deduction or a credit. It makes it hard to find revenue sources. So as I've gone around the state, privilege of meeting and all these citizens, we've talked about what's fair, and I will tell you, we didn't all agree on what's fair. We didn't all agree on what was simple, and we didn't all agree on what would support economic growth. But people, by and large, did really feel committed to fixing problems and telling me to go back and work with the legislature and work with the governor and come up with a tax plan that we can that we'll release next Tuesday, that we can bring to you and have a great discussion about in terms of how do we go about solving these long-term problems. We talk about the puzzle of tax reform and whether it will work. You know, I've got a boss who's very committed to tax reform, and I know a lot of you are, and I hope that we can work together to do that. We've got committed staff, organizations, and the citizens out there have really been very, very supportive. So they've been giving us ideas. I've been very pleased to have the opportunity to talk to all these citizens. They tell me they want the system fixed. They tell me that they want property taxes reduced. They tell me that they want value for their dollar. You'll notice there were no spending slides in this presentation. But I will tell you, every single meeting we had, somebody would say, well, this is fine, Commissioner, about the revenue system and fixing it, but how much money should we raise? And the issue about what should we spend this money on, about our priorities, always came up. We thought we should put a slide in there about it, but we didn't have to because somebody would always bring it up, and we would have that discussion about not only deciding how to raise revenue, but deciding how much revenue to raise and what we should be paying for. So with that, I rushed through that, but I wanted to get a chance for you to have questions, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. And being one of the 84 legislators who had the opportunity to listen to your presentation this summer, and then, of course, have the great meal at the Trails End, which
yes, that was great.
I do remember. I think I'll just open it up to the committee for questions. Senator Bach?
Thank you. Commissioner, slide 21, page 21, shows the two stools.
Yes.
And it shows in 2010 that the legs on the stool have changed to the point where it appears like the stool doesn't stand up. But there's not a date on when the balance system was in place of roughly a third property, a third sales, a third income. Is there kind of a point in time where the trend line started to change and the sales tax started to shrink and the property tax started to grow, or is it just kind of eroded over the decades, or is there kind of a date when we were pretty relatively balanced?
Mr. Chair, Senator,
Friends.
We picked 1999. They were relatively balanced in 1999. There, the property tax was about 30%, and sales tax and income tax were about the same. And we picked that point because that was before some of the income tax changes that really reduced the income taxes. It's been eroding since then. So it's been sort of a steady erosion. And obviously the economy has an effect on it from time to time. But 1999 was the last year that we really looked at being fairly balanced and being eroded since then.
Senator Newman.
FDL.
Commissioner, if you could go to slide 27 on sales tax. What is reflected is that it looks like the more folks earn in terms of disposable income, the less percentage of sales tax they pay, and that seems what am I missing? It would seem to me that the more people have in terms of disposable income, the more money they would buy buy goods and so forth, and would consequently pay more in sales tax. What am I missing?
Well, Chair and Senator, there is obviously an element of choice in the sales tax, which is which is something that that you have to look to. And so what really happens over over the income brackets that we have in front of us is you just simply have so much more disposable income at the upper income levels. And so when you look at the spending patterns of those in the lower income brackets, whatever they spend on, whatever items they spend on, it's a higher percentage of their income. And so I think one of the things we're seeing here is that for all sales taxes, that the more disposable income you have, it's just simply you're just not going to spend that much on item, personal items or consumable items.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Newman, did that answer?
Yes, thank you.
Senator Nelson and then Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Chairman Skoy. Commissioner, my thinking is kind of along the same line. The importance about percent is always what it's a percent of. And I noticed on slide 10 that that shows the state and local revenue as a percent of personal income. And then a few slides later in 19, where it showed how the middle class is shrinking and the number of folks in lower incomes grew by 4%, but the number of Minnesotans in those upper income brackets grew by 6%. And so I think that's a good thing that we're growing in that direction. But my question is, with more people being in the upper income brackets, is it necessarily, I mean, one could think that because of that, there might not be as great of need for some state services. And I'm thinking of some of the larger parts of our budget. Some parts there still are. But my question is, with incomes rising in a portion of our state, our population, is it necessarily an accurate measure to measure our state budget as a percent of personal income? Because it seems like they might be, the greater the personal income, maybe in some cases the less state spending might be necessary.
And Commissioner Franz, are you counting people or are you counting dollars on that graph? Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair and Senator, you know, one of the let's go to the one about showing the shrinking middle class first. I think what you have to be careful of there is that we're talking percentage. Once you're right that what you're multiplying the percentage against is important. So the total number of people obviously is increasing. So even though you're seeing a shift in the percentage of people in the total population from 1971 to 2011, we have an overall population increase. So there are more people in each one of those brackets. And so that's one of the things you're seeing there. Is there what the Pew Research Center did was try to figure out, based on their parameters, what percentage of people are in those middle brackets. Their report actually shows you the number of people in each one of those categories too. So that particular slide, you've got to remember that even though there are more people in the upper income bracket, and that's a U.S. slide, by the way, not Minnesota. So once you look at that in the upper income bracket, it's true there are more people, and that's a good thing for those folks that are succeeding. But there are a lot more people in the lower income bracket just by sheer numbers. So that's where the budget issue comes in a little bit differently. In terms of the comparing the cost of government to personal income, it's just one of the ways of trying to be able to compare one state to another state. So there are other ways to measure the amount of money being spent at state and local levels, but that's one way where we try to make sure that we can compare ourselves from one state to another state. And that's why that measure is used.
Could I have a follow-up question, please, Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Oh, I just briefly, Commissioner Showalter, on the percent of income, you made a nice distinction between the regressive taxes and the progressive taxes. And it'd be interesting to see on that sales tax that, it has to do with percentage and what those numbers mean, but of those upper income levels, what percent of the sales taxes do they pay, not necessarily what percent of their income? And I'm wondering if you have that data.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that data is in the incidence report. But I'll double check on that and make sure I get that to you if it's
Thank
not
you.
Readily available. I think Senator just promoted me to Commissioner Showalter.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Commissioner Showalter?
I took that as a compliment.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy that Commissioner France answered that question.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Newman's point about the sales tax, I think it's important to note that as the incomes go up, people are more likely to buy services, and they are not taxed. And so services along with the goods that they buy, those items don't get taxed. Commissioner Franz, just a comment about tax reform generally. I think it's good that you've gone around the state and talked about tax reform. I think educating Minnesotans about tax policy is a really good thing. But I'm concerned that it's coupled with the governor's plan to raise taxes. And I'm not sure that has been adequately communicated. And I'm concerned. Tax reform is not the same thing as raising taxes. And I hope that you and your messaging and the governor in his messaging will clear that up. Because otherwise it looks like a wolf in sheep's clothing to me. I mean, I've heard all kinds of proposals to raise taxes to spend money. And people want to spend a lot more here at the legislature. The proposals are in the billions now. And so I think it's incumbent upon you and the governor to be very clear about that. And I also think that raising taxes now would be a terrible idea for the state of Minnesota. And lest you forget, the federal government just raised taxes. They just raised payroll taxes on every Minnesotan that earns a living and raised taxes on income earners, joint income earners over $400,000. And so we are already going to have a very significant impact from those taxes that will be imposed as of January of this year. I'm very concerned about the economic impacts of that. So I would ask you, number one, be very clear. Is the governor raising taxes? Because I think that's what he's proposing, and I don't think it should be mixed up with the reform. And secondly, I think you should look again after what just happened with the federal government about whether this is the right time.
Well, Senator Ortman, I've just flipped through this presentation. I don't see any of these slides that talk about tax increases. But Commissioner France?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think I would like to be really clear that one of the things that will be presented on January 22nd with the governor's budget and revenue package is to solve problems, and to solve problems that have existed in terms of the number of deficits, 8 deficits in the last 11 years, concerned about trying to make sure that Minnesota's investing in those education and infrastructure issues that are important to Minnesota. So his message is going to be really clear, and I think one of his clarity, the issues that he'll be clear about is where are we spending money and how should we spend that, and what's the most fair way that we can raise revenue that will support that budget. And so the concept of tax reform is to make sure that everyone pays their fair share. It's a system where we develop a revenue source that is sustainable and will support the government at the level that we need to support in Minnesota. So that will be his message, I think, on January 22nd.
And we're looking forward to that. Senator Ortman.
There's no question in my mind that Governor Dayton is proposing both. He's been promising for years that he is going to raise income taxes in the state of Minnesota. And it's to my point, Mr. Chair, that this whole proposal doesn't even talk about those tax increases that he intends to go along with the reform. And reform in and of itself is not necessarily a good thing. I think some reform may be needed, but reform is in the eye of the beholder, because every time that you eliminate some tax break or change the percentages of taxes that are paid, that will impact some taxpayer. And so I think we need to say that you can't do this in a vacuum. It can't just be policy. There is an impact. And so, again, I hope that you will be very clear. The governor is going to have to put out some very strong messaging to say that he's doing both. He's not just reforming. He's also proposing more tax increases to pay for more spending. I think that's important.
And Senator Ortman, I think Governor Dayton was pretty clear about some of those provisions in his campaign. But with regard to the reform provision, I've noticed that Senator Rest in her bill introductions has been introducing revenue neutral so that we can actually have discussion about the policy and the impacts and the procedures of how these changes are going to work in the system. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Franz. Is there a way, I've got a couple questions, but one is that there's probably going to be some changes at the federal level in terms of the tax climate. Would there be a way that the state could prepare for those changes so that as the federal changes take place, that we would actually piggyback onto the federal changes and maybe incorporate more, hopefully more simplified tax structure, and one that would generate additional revenues? Because as you mentioned, about, I think it was $11 billion, there's about $11 billion in tax breaks that we have incorporated into our tax system. That's one question, and I don't expect an answer on that. But the other one is, as we look and move forward, I think a goal should be for all of us would be to figure out how we can keep our state competitive in the region, let's say, not nationally, obviously, but I think regionally, too. I mean, like if you look at the sales tax compared from one state to the next, or if you look at certain breaks that one state might have versus another. I think the more that we can stay consistent with surrounding areas, the better off we are, because we don't end up losing money in terms of tax breaks.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you know, we do have some concerns. As you know, on January 2nd, 2013, Congress passed the most recent tax bill, changing items for tax year 2012, which presents us with a problem immediately about conformity. And so I think we're going to have those concerns throughout this Congress. I don't think we're going to be able to anticipate all of those. We're going to have to be able to react to some of them. And frankly, one of our concerns is, maybe concern is not the right word, but one of the things we want to be very cognizant of is Congress's willingness or ability to do something on the tax reform in terms of deductions or credits or simplifying the individual income tax system, because that's something we have to watch very closely. So we'll have to keep that in mind as we go through this year and through our session here is what's going on in Congress, if anything, but I do think we need to be very careful of that. So thank you.
And Senator Stumpf, the tax conformity that you're alluding to with the federal government and what Commissioner Franz just talked about for 2012, there's a cost to that of a little less than $20 million for the 12 conformity, and the 13-14 conformity is around $190 million. So in this era of shortfall, we're trying to figure out how to balance the conformity for Minnesota taxpayers with the cost that the state would have to incur. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a discussion about how we compare our raising of funds to pay budgets to a three-legged stool. I think maybe that idea is a little bit dated. I look at it instead of a three-legged stool, I look at it as three ingredients to a recipe. Because we know there's other states that if we were going to look at the sources of revenue, they don't rely on some revenue as much as we do. Take, for example, those seven or eight states that don't even have a corporate income tax. Well, that's one whole leg to the stool that's gone. And yet, at the same time, some of these states don't even have an income tax for their individual citizens. So they reinvent the recipe a little bit differently. And so if you get away from the three-legged stool idea, then the question of having a balanced stool to begin with has to be raised as well. As I'm looking at the budget, and I haven't heard it yet, but Minnesota has been, by the Tax Foundation, has been considered one of the a 47th state, worst state to do business in. Now, that's a reputable Tax Foundation organization. They aren't necessarily conservative or Republican. But the question is how does this budget other than the goal, as you stated, Commissioner, to raise revenue to pay for our budget, how is it going to inspire economic development when we are contemplating raising income tax on those that are trying to expand their own livelihood, expand their businesses, put more people to work? How are we going to inspire those people? I know whenever I bring this up, there's always someone in the room that'll say, well, we have 20 of the Fortune 500. That's good enough for us. But that's only maybe 13% of the entire workforce in the state of Minnesota. The real workforce is the 85 or 87% of smaller businesses. That's the ones that I'm more concerned about. The big companies are going to take care of themselves. They can even put a loss leader in the state of Minnesota and keep their operation here at a loss, because in other states they're making scads of money based on other states having a much more advantageous tax event for them. So how does this budget inspire economic development?
Commissioner France and Senator Limbert, just so I clarify the question just a little bit, are you talking about the Small Business Entrepreneurship Council rating that I think they refer to the that we have multiple revenue sources as a negative and that we have a high published rate, but they don't recognize the effective rate?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you want to reframe where my question that I want
to
do.
Well, I wasn't clear on the question, I guess.
I want to know, is there any hope to expand businesses and expand production and in turn expand salaries for people in the state of Minnesota out of this budget? Are we going in that direction, or are we just kind of bowing to the idea that we have a budget, but we aren't necessarily going to talk about cutting anything in the budget overall? So the whole goal of the budget is just, or the whole goal of the proposal we have is to sustain a budget. I'm wanting to know, is there anything in the sustaining part that will inspire economic development?
Commissioner France.
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, I'm going to leave the inspiring to my boss, the governor, on January 22nd, because one of the things I know that he will want to address and will address is the investments in the budget and why the budget he proposes and why the revenue system he proposes will encourage growth in Minnesota. I think one of the things that when we started this process, we simply laid everything on the table and said, what do we need to consider? What are the different elements, both on the budget side with Commissioner Showalter and on the revenue side with myself? What are those things we need to consider that will make the budget be a document that we believe will inspire people, will be one that they agree with, that has a kind of investments and the kind of scrutiny over spending that Minnesotans want to come to understand? So I think that's what the governor's working toward. He's working very hard on that. He's been meeting with all the commissioners, all the different participants in the budget side, the spending side. We've been meeting a lot on the revenue side. And so I think on Tuesday when you see his presentation, you'll see that the budget he proposes will have those ingredients that will inspire confidence, will inspire long-term growth in Minnesota.
Just Commissioner Franz, when your introduction you talk about Minnesota being a great state. And then on slide 15, I think this is to the heart of Senator Limmer's question. And if you folks wanted to turn there, this Ernst Young says yes, and the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council says no. What are some of the things that they're waiting to give us the negative rating there? What's going on with that?
Mr. Chair, I think one of the things, when you look at ratings, as I mentioned in that slide, and I think it's always a good discussion to have, is when you start making comparison, there are studies out there that put Minnesota right in the middle of the pack when it comes to overall taxes, in terms of tax burden in this country. And I think one of the things that when we look at these statistics, you have to look at, are the statistics measuring the statutory rate, or are they measuring the effective rate? And so it really becomes important. I mean, I know that we certainly take seriously the statutory rate because that is what we call the billboard rate, or that's the rate that people look at when they come to the state. So the statutory rate is certainly something you need to look at and be concerned with, but also you need to look at the effective rate. Can you make the effective rate be as low as possible for folks? You know, when you look at the sales tax rate, the 6.875 statewide sales tax rate, and compare it to the other states in this region, it is on the high side. And we clearly look at that, and we're concerned about that. And I think those kinds of issues are things that we've all tried to deal with in this budget and looking at this overall package is where can we make those changes? How do we make Minnesota competitive and compare well with other states?
Chairman.
Senator Loomis.
I did not make reference in my comments regarding the 47th percent worst business climate in the country regarding or highlighting the source as a small business and an entrepreneurship council. It was the tax foundation that I was making a reference to. I just want to make that as a footnote to this discussion. Completely different organization.
Yeah, well, I understand, Senator Limmer. We just try to, you know, we hear that Minnesota's such a negative place to do business, and I'd like to be operating under factual information. And you look at this graph and you see such disparate, you know, outcome results. You want to make sure that we understand what's going on. And I think there's information available that shows that, you know, Minnesota really is a pretty good place to do business. And obviously we want to do better, but we'd like to make sure that we're being accurate there.
Mr. Chairman, we've both been around this a long time, and we know that
there's
lots.
We've probably had this discussion before, Senator.
Yeah, we've had that discussion before, and we also know that there's a variety of sources, a variety of statisticians out there that point us in different directions. Sometimes subtly the same, but for the purposes of the subtleties, it benefits one political argument over another. I'm waiting for the fact that all of the statisticians point in the same direction. And if they don't, then I think we have a problem.
You know, Senator Lehrer, one of the first discussions I had with Commissioner Franz was how glad we were that we were on the tax committee where we dealt with numbers and numbers weren't subject to spin. But I guess maybe we're not quite right there. Senator Sanjim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure after the the last commentaries here that I'm going to really ask my question because it too related to slide 15. But maybe just ask a question of the chair, and to this page, is our system our current tax system competitive? And we have a page here that says yes, and we have a page that says no. And so, and frankly, those yeses and nos are on the extremes. One says within the top 10%, others say on the other side of that 10%, and so we sit here. You know, if we were sitting here saying this morning that, well, we're 25th, there would be some of us that would say, well, can we ever get to be 21? And there would be some that would say, maybe we could go to 29 and it wouldn't hurt us so much, but at least we'd kind of know where we are. And so my plea, Mr. Chair, is somewhere along the line, you know, can we define this a little bit better? Because I will tell you, it's, for me, it's been the argument that existed for the last 10 years. We come and our side will say, because we go out to businesses and say, they tell us that, you know, your tax rate in Minnesota is not competitive and we're not going to expand our business here. So, you know, so we get that message. And perhaps the other side gets another message, and I would tend to agree with this, that workforce is important, and it is. We all know that. We have to have a strong workforce, and we probably have to tax a degree to get to that strong workforce. So there is this balance, but we don't seem to be able to find it in our commentary and our arguments. And I will just suggest that we're going to argue about this one all session unless we define it a little bit better and then try to find, you know, are we really competitive or aren't we? Are we 33rd or are we 17th or what are we? And we don't have to be that exact. I don't mean that, but when we get this yes, no, and to both extremes, it makes it pretty difficult, I think, for policymakers to understand this argument and reach any conclusion. So my plea, and not a question, but just a plea to the chair, maybe we can uncover this a little bit further during the course of our tax hearings and understand it better.
I think you're right, Senator Sanjim, and different businesses bring different requests to the legislature. I remember when the commissioner of AGCO was contemplating moving to Jackson, and his request to the legislature was that he have a nice livable community with good schools and good health care so he could recruit engineers. Yeah. You know, and the same thing, Roseau, you know, when they had that flood, the CEO or the financial officer for Polaris was down here, you know, asking for some help rebuilding their community so, you know, they could develop again. And so, you know, we've kind of got to sort all of that out, too, as we go through this. But I think you're absolutely right. If we can get a better understanding of it, that'd be helpful. We've got a pretty good list, so we're going to move along here. Senator Tomsoni.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, I've been listening to my colleagues, mostly from the other side of the aisle, indicate that taxes are a reason businesses don't come to Minnesota or don't want to be in Minnesota. And yet, we, in front of the Economic Development Committee last year, we had some businessmen come before us who indicated that on a survey of what makes businesses decide to locate in a certain place, taxes was 26th on the list of things that they consider. And then I was listening to, and it might have been one of you gentlemen on the radio, had a call in, and the person said he had started 5 new businesses in Minnesota over the years, and that if you think that taxes are the reason that businesses decide to locate in Minnesota or not locate in Minnesota, you're crazy. And that came right out of the guy's mouth who had just opened 5 new businesses in Minnesota. And Senator Limmer just indicated that, well, geez, you mentioned Fortune 500 companies in Minnesota as if it's not an important thing. It's a very important thing to mention 21 Fortune 500 companies located in the state of Minnesota. And so are taxes the reason? Is this a negative place to do business? Well, point to the 9.8% corporate income tax rate. They don't pay it. They pay 3%, if that. And so, you know, the facts have to get out there. And I keep looking at what has been happening in the state of Minnesota, and Senator Bach asked the question of when did the stool start tipping over. And 1999 was when the stool started tipping over. Well, if I remember correctly, 1998 was the year that we reduced income tax rates in Minnesota, and we suddenly started collecting $2 billion less than we used to collect. And all of a sudden, tuition started going up at our colleges. Property taxes started going up. Funding for K-12 education system went down. Our healthcare system started becoming underfunded, and we started running into all kinds of problems we never had before. So, you know, there's a real lot of things that taxes do that are really good, and holding down tuition is a really good one, and keeping our K-12 system funded is a really good one, and making sure that our people have healthcare is a really good one. And so as you go across your tax deliberations, and I'm not on the committee, but as you go across these, I think you have to consider what taxes do that are good and what has happened to the state of Minnesota over the last 10 years in regards to our ratings nationally, in regards to our businesses, and in regards to our educational system, in regards to our healthcare system, and especially in regards to our property taxes. Because I sort of heard Senator Nelson indicate that she thought rich people should pay more because they're making more money and they don't need the services. So maybe that's something that, I mean, I don't know if that's what she was thinking, but it certainly sounded that way. And I think you have a lot of things to talk about, but I think among everything here, we should really find out if businesses aren't coming to Minnesota because of the tax system, or if, I think, like Mr. Showalter said at one point in time, we've had a record number of businesses start up in Minnesota lately. And so the whole rhetoric and political error that we're hearing here needs to be put aside, and the actual what's best for Minnesota needs to be decided in the tax committee.
We're going to wrap up here in about 5 minutes, so maybe we'll move back to the question part of this committee hearing. Senator Bonner.
As I look at your three-legged stool, I am aware that that the sales tax, we all agree, is disproportionately small compared to other states, and that our property tax line has stool leg has grown quite a bit. As I look at various charts, it shows us about in the middle of the pack with regard to our property tax burden compared to other states. As I recall, something like 29th. But I'm wondering if you could dissect that for me. Are we middle of the pack with regard to residential property tax? And does that combine the business property tax? And do you know where we fall on each of those distinctly with regard to other states?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, excellent question. I think one of the things we have found that the residential property tax is sort of in the middle of the pack, if you will, with other states. Even though we have had this increase the last decade in actual property taxes compared to other states, we are still sort of in the middle of the pack. But from what I've been hearing, and we haven't really been able to nail this down as much as I would like, one of the things we've been hearing from businesses is a concern that business, the statewide business tax, is on the high side compared to other states. As you know, about 30-some percent of each business's property tax is the statewide property tax. That's the component it usually makes up. And so that is a concern, and we're looking into trying to figure out how we do relate to the rest of the country. But those two are not in lockstep, it appears, and that's what we've discovered thus far.
Senator Miller, did you have a question? Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Franz, going back to the three-legged stool, it looks like the income tax, that goes back to 1999, as you mentioned, the income tax portion has been relatively stable, and it seems like the unbalance is between the property taxes and the sales tax. So obviously I think that's where we need to focus, not so much on the income tax. But my question to you, we recently received some good news from the Secretary of State's office that about 18% of new businesses started in 2012, which is great news. And we talked a little bit about the corporate income taxes, and I think the Fortune 500 companies are extremely important to the state of Minnesota, but so are the small and medium-sized businesses. And my question to you or to Commissioner Showalter is, what percentage of businesses in the state of Minnesota are either classified as a sole proprietorship or an S-corp or another business that they're actually taxed through our individual income tax rates and not through the corporate income tax rates?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you know, I don't have that figure in front of me. I know we do have that information in terms of classification, and so I'll get that for you. I'm sorry I don't have that in front of me right now, though. But you're right, there is a distinction in how those are classified.
And Commissioner Franz, when you're answering that, perhaps you'd split that out by the low, medium, and top tax rates so we can kind of get a feel for where they lie. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll pass just to say I have a feeling we will spend a lot of time discussing the difference between our billboard rates and effective rates, because that gap is meaningful. And I would like to come back at some point, Mr. Chair, and I know Senator Rest will probably be tackling this idea, but in discussion it was sort of implied that tax reform was optional, and I really don't think that's where we're at because of the complication, the lack of transparency, and the instability in our taxes. So,
and we're going to wrap up. Senator Rest gets the last word, but tax committee members, we're going to leave. The finance committee is going to stay here and do confirmation hearing. Senator Cohen?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So everybody in the finance, if you can just rather than go upstairs, we'll save some time. If you stay here for a couple minutes, we'll clean up the table, bring our stuff down, and be out of here that much sooner.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is a question that does deal with the whole thing of effective rates and statutory rates. And the tax man of one corporation recently said that we really should be paying attention to the statutory rate and not just concentrating on talking about for corporate income taxes the low rate, because on the on marginal increases in their taxable income, they do pay it at the statutory rate, and it does. And I was wondering, when you look at establishing the effective rate and corporate income increases being paid at the statutory rate, not at the effective rate, in your calculations, do you take that into account in then raising the effective rate from the status quo? Does that question make sense?
Commissioner Franz.
Chair, Senator, I'm not sure where you're going with that in terms of
when corporations, C corps, and I appreciate Senator Miller's distinction, because a lot of small businesses don't operate as C corps. when they earn additional dollars, they're not paying at an effective rate. They're paying at that marginal rate. And I was wondering, when you're doing your calculations, does that make any difference about establishing what the effective rate is, and does that fluctuate over time?
Mr. Chair, Senator, from our perspective, when we follow the rates, it does make a difference in terms of the amount of money we collect. I don't know exactly how you folks work it into your forecast, if there's changes in the rates and whether it's effective rate or the statutory rate. But from our perspective, when we see productivity or increasing or economic activity increasing and corporations making more money, it is clearly on the upper end of that. The higher rate that they're paying, the higher effective rate. So that's, we estimate that in terms of our income models. We use that to sort of project how much we think they'll pay over the next year. So we do look at the increasing higher effective rate they end up paying by the increased rate. So we do look at that in our projections.
And so my point would be,
Senator Esten,
when you reduce the statutory rate, it does have an effect on the on the effective rate. The effective rate is not static. It does not stay the same. It is influenced by the statutory rate, and we need to pay attention to that, would be my question and my point.
Thank you, Senator Rest, and thank you, members. Good ongoing discussion. Looking forward to hearing the governor's proposal as it comes out on the 22nd and continuing this debate. This committee is adjourned. Senator.
Well, and then thanks to the commissioners and to Dr. Stinson. And again, finance members, if you can just stay right here, we got the packets to distribute immediately.
Committee adjourned.
We're meeting here.
Yeah.